Hello, and welcome to episode 17 of the Unpacking Weight Science podcast called Dieting, Illness, and Malnutrition at Every Size. I'm your host, Fiona Willer, weight neutral professional development dietitian, academic, and size acceptance advocate. Malnutrition is a condition that has both short-term and long-lasting consequences. In this episode, I'll unpack the science of malnutrition, its signs and symptoms, and as always, how our intentional weight loss focus results in dangerous malnutrition invisibility. Our learning goals today are to recognise the hallmark signs of undernutrition across a weight span, identify the risks associated with undernutrition across a lifespan, and appreciate the differences in consensus statement development methodology, literature review versus Delphi method. So the term malnutrition is understood by the general public as referring to someone who is a much lower weight than would be expected and with a wasted, frail appearance. In essence, a very low weight state caused by insufficient nourishment. In the scientific literature over the past few decades, malnutrition has come to have an expanded definition to include what they describe as overnutrition, or, you guessed it, obesity. Obviously, I have issues with this that I'm going to come back to. To keep things clear here, I'm going to use the term malnutrition to denote undernutrition and use overnutrition when talking about eating in excess of the body's nutritional and energy requirements. In dietetics, we tend to use the term malnutrition similarly to as is understood by the general public, that is, to denote undernutrition. This can mean either or both of inadequate energy intake or inadequate intake of one or more nutrients. One of our key clinical privileges is the skill to diagnose malnutrition and malnutrition risk, usually in a hospital setting, and usually with the aim to not put them into a worse nutritional state while they're in hospital. A malnourished state points to having had insufficient energy intake for long enough that muscle and fat tissue have been cannibalized as an energy source to keep the essential body processes going, or the way someone has been eating for an extended period of time has led to one or more nutrient deficiencies. At risk of malnutrition is an assessment based on the eating and medical circumstances that, if continued, would eventually result in a malnourished state. Remember, a diet that's theoretically inadequate in a nutrient is not the same as a nutrient deficiency in a body. You can have a diet that's insufficient in micronutrients, but that doesn't prove a micronutrient deficiency in the person. That actually has to be diagnosed with other types of tests. Loads of times as a lecturer marking first year assignments, students accidentally conflate a nutrient deficient diet with a nutrient deficiency. Remember, one is assessed using dietary intake analysis, like surveys, weighed food records, and food composition data. Databases, and the other is assessed with blood and other physiological tests. Malnourished people tend to have longer hospital stays, and this means that they cost more to treat than people who come in well-nourished. Just think of our frail little old lady with the broken hip and now hip replacement, who needs to be medically stable enough to get up and use that new hip in order to get off to rehab and in the community centre out of the hospital. Having surgery and even just being hospitalised, laying around in a hospital bed for days, is associated with muscle wasting and loss of strength and condition. Hospital dietitians try to make sure that she has enough to heal her wound and not lose excessive muscle mass, so she's on the trajectory for an uncomplicated recovery and can get the hell out of there and make room for the next patient. Hospital-related wasting is a big issue, and people who are hospitalised are often already malnourished or at least at risk of malnutrition when they're admitted as well. In terms of types of malnutrition, we have primary malnutrition and secondary malnutrition. Primary malnutrition caused by insufficient dietary intake includes insufficient energy intake and insufficient nutrient intake. So, for example, iron deficiency would point to a malnourished state at any weight, the body's functions being compromised by the lack of an essential component to usual metabolic function, as would a wasted state as a result of famine, food insecurity, or severe weight loss dieting, which can also happen at any weight. So primary malnutrition is as a result of not enough to eat. Secondary malnutrition, where wasting is due to a disease process, this is essentially because some conditions cause both an increase in energy requirements and a decrease in appetite or reduced capacity to absorb nutrients from the gastrointestinal tract, and some conditions also use increased amounts of micronutrients, so can hasten the development of micronutrient deficiencies. For example, some types of cancer, dysentery, infection, chronic respiratory conditions can all lead to secondary malnutrition. So you can predict from those definitions that primary and secondary malnutrition often also occur together. Part of this is because primary malnutrition makes you more susceptible to opportunistic infections, which then lead to factors that promote secondary malnutrition. And with a significant proportion of the adult population with a BMI of greater than 25, there is then, of course, going to be a significant incidence of both primary and secondary malnutrition in people with larger bodies. Primary malnutrition is caused by food insecurity and intentional weight loss efforts, including disordered eating and eating disorders and dieting. And secondary malnutrition is caused by all the illnesses that are caused by malnutrition in smaller bodied people as well. Most large health organizations define undernutrition without a weight or BMI qualifier. So UNICEF calls it the outcome of insufficient food intake. The National Institute of Health calls it insufficient intake of energy and nutrients to meet an individual's needs to maintain good health. The World Health Organization says there are four broad subforms of undernutrition: wasting, stunting, underweight, and deficiencies in vitamins and minerals. Undernutrition makes children in particular much more vulnerable to disease and death. The World Health Organization fact sheet on malnutrition is all over the place, though. They say that malnutrition in all its forms includes undernutrition, so wasting, stunting, underweight, inadequate vitamins and minerals, but also overweight, obesity, and resulting diet-related non-communicable diseases. This essentially means that they're claiming that heart disease doesn't happen to well-nourished people with BMIs between 18.5 and 25. Obviously, that's BS. The ABS data from the Australian Health Survey shows that 4.3% of so-called normal weight adults in Australia have cardiovascular disease, and 90% of adult Australians with a BMI of greater than 30 do not have cardiovascular disease. Yes, the risk is higher, but that makes it a risk factor, not diagnostic of disease. So the World Health Organization also makes a mistake of assuming that a BMI over 25 or 30 is evidence of current overnutrition or excessive energy intake, and clearly this is not actually fair. Many academic papers also position obesity as caloric overnourishment. But a weight-stable, larger person is not overdoing anything. Their body is in steady-state homeostasis, functioning in exactly the same way as a lower weight, stable body weight person. And this assertion comes from the incorrect belief that people with larger bodies continually eat in excess of their biological requirements to stay that way, as if just eating to appetite or eating what a smaller bodied person eats will result in magical sustained weight suppression. And we now know overwhelmingly that bodies don't do this, not how it works. Again, we have a theme of an entrenched assumption that a body size is a direct expression of energy balance. What the weight is doing from one time point to another may be a proxy for energy balance during those two time points, and I'm talking over weeks to months because there's no objective way to assess if any one meal or one day was eating to excessive requirements, because weight-stable bodies fluctuate hugely in both what they require from day to day and what they eat from day to day. Body size is independent thing that's regulated by highly complex metabolic processes, some of which we can override a bit, but we're tinkering with a machine that continually surprises us with its redundant processes in everything from metabolic pathways to the psychological consequences of trying to override internal eating regulation. At best, a larger body might be considered an outcome of a historical period of overnutrition. But then this is only accurate if the body used to be a smaller one. There are many people who are larger bodied throughout their entire lives. Knowing that the body fights to maintain in the realm of its highest adult body weight, using body weight as an indication of current eating habits is highly invalid. It's also not like the body has unlimited storage space for all nutrients other than fat. All micronutrients that are consumed, once the body's had enough in its stores, are either metabolized, excreted, or reach levels considered toxic because they block normal metabolic processes or cause adverse effects on their own. A human who is eating a varied diet with enough energy from regular foods to maintain their current body weight is not going to get anywhere near toxic levels of micronutrients, no matter their size. If they're so keen to pin down this concept of overnutrition, it should be reserved for situations where someone is in a weight gain period that's also not a resolution of a previous weight suppression. Would we consider someone who is recovering from low weight wasted undernutrition and who is gaining weight as part of that process as overnourished? No, clearly not. And yet if someone is in a larger body who's recovering from wasted undernutrition, they're readily classed as overnourished on the basis of their BMI alone, regardless of their actual weight history and nutrition history. We have this bias towards treating weight gain as a bad thing, except when it's associated with recovery from malnutrition, except if the malnourished person has a higher body weight, in which case the person is somehow supposed to recover from weight-suppressed malnutrition without regaining weight. It's another case of Schrödinger's fat. A much more scientifically valid way to think about human body weight is to think of a person's normal weight as the weight that their body stabilizes at when they're eating flexibly to their appetite, an effortless weight, whatever that may be for that person. Sometimes this is referred to as their habitual weight in the literature, so that may be a lower weight for some people and a higher weight for others. Either way, that stable weight under flexible, autonomous eating conditions is the baseline from which to consider the meaning of any weight changes. It should be considered as a well-nourished state if their diet is varied and they have no evidence of nutrient deficiencies. The Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics in the US has a consensus statement with ASPEN, that's the American Society for Parenteral and Enteral Nutrition, so basically tube feeds and vein feeds, relating to adult undernutrition, which I'm going to spend some time going through now. The document openly recognises that undernutrition is an issue at any weight, but focuses on secondary malnutrition, that caused by a disease process rather than undernutrition caused by intentional food restriction. It's important to recognise that these two circumstances are quite different. Illness severe enough to cause chronic insufficient energy intake comes with its own markers of things like inflammation and fatigue. The biochemical picture of people whose undernutrition is caused by illness may look quite different from those whose undernutrition is caused by intentional food restriction or food insecurity. Larger bodied people tend to have higher levels of inflammatory markers when in energy balance, and markers of inflammation are suppressed during energy restriction, masking the true level of inflammatory markers in that person. This means that there's a risk that underlying reasons for increased inflammatory markers are missed. That is, a larger person who's becoming malnourished via both intentional weight loss and a disease process may have increased inflammatory markers than usual in their weight stable state, which are now being suppressed to an extent while they diet. But because markers of inflammation are known to be higher in people with larger bodies, the inflammatory markers are dismissed as being due to fat instead of being caused or exacerbated by illness. And when we look at the effect of weight loss on markers of inflammation in studies of groups of people, it's really important to separate out intentional weight loss from unintentional weight loss. And of course, while we continue to systematically coerce all larger people to try to lose weight, there will always be people who are experiencing illness related to weight loss while simultaneously trying to lose weight. They feel elated that their diet's finally working, while unbeknownst to them and their medical professionals, they're actually delaying the diagnosis of something life-threatening, potentially until it's too late. Researchers who study malnutrition in developing nations talk about there being three levels of causes of undernutrition: biological, behavioural, and social. And I find this a useful lens to use because it was developed without the prejudicial effect of fat phobia. Biological causes and risk factors include disease and malabsorption, so what I've talked about as secondary malnutrition already. Behavioural causes occur at the household level and include insufficient access to food, inappropriate feeding practices, and food safety. So these are causes of primary malnutrition. And one step away from the household are the societal causes, which include political, cultural, religious, and social systems that influence the household level factors. So by providing the perfect storm for negative behavioural factors, societal factors are also causes of primary malnutrition. So let's look at malnutrition caused by intentional weight loss through this lens. Intentional weight loss dieting is indistinguishable from famine by the body and is thus a behavioural cause of primary malnutrition. A thin bias and fat phobia can be considered a societal risk factor for primary malnutrition, and a household norm of dieting is then a behavioural risk factor. We recommend intentional weight loss to larger bodied people without known disease, as well as people with larger bodies who have health issues already. So all three levels are in play. And there's going to be an acceleration of secondary malnutrition via dieting-induced primary malnutrition in these cases. I'm not going to spend much more time talking about physical illness-induced malnutrition. I want to focus on contextualising weight loss dieting and malnutrition. Keep in mind that the physical illness-induced malnutrition, so secondary malnutrition, occurs across the weight span too, and is often minimised by healthcare professionals caring for people with larger bodies, the they have enough storage argument. And I've said it before, fat tissue isn't a proper doomsday bunker. It's a short-term, mostly energy-only reserve. Other much more critical nutrients run out far more quickly than fat tissue. And if you're assuming that everything is okay nutritionally because of a larger body, you're missing important factors that may tank your patient. But it is pretty tricky to assess malnutrition, so using blood markers isn't reliable, we know that. Assessors also aren't great at being objective in their physical assessments. You can't accurately measure weight loss or body condition changes without having accurate starting measurements. So it's a bit like trying to assess somebody's dietary intake by only using the remnants left on their plate without properly knowing what was on their plate to begin with. Coming back to that consensus statement on malnutrition from the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics in the US, they have identified six clinical characteristics of which you need to have only two in order for malnutrition to be diagnosed. They're insufficient energy intake, weight loss, loss of subcutaneous fat, loss of muscle mass, fluid retention, and diminished functional capacity. And I'm going to go through these now in more detail and talk about where intentional weight loss fits in all of this. So firstly, there needs to be insufficient energy intake. The person isn't eating enough to meet their biological requirements for homeostasis, a regular, normal, steady state body function. If they've eaten less than 75% of their requirements for at least 3 months, that may be indicative of mild to moderate malnutrition. Or if they've eaten less than 50% of their requirements for more than 3 months, that may be indicative of severe malnutrition. Now keep in mind also that no method of calculating energy requirements is perfect, which also means that the studies from which these diagnostic cutoffs are based and your efforts to try to prove specific energy deficit are pretty rocky. Also recognise that when larger people are studied for their dietary habits, they're almost always accused of underreporting their food intake. On average, humans aren't good at remembering or quantifying what we eat, so just about everyone accidentally underreports, except people who are on a diet and who do know literally everything they've eaten, but that's not really a normal eating state. The problem is that there are going to be people who are accurately reporting what they ate, but who are dismissed as having underreported because of their body size. Larger people are told all the time to restrict their food intake, and then when they do, they're accused of underreporting, and quite often their data is removed from studies as it's deemed as implausibly low energy intake. Insufficient energy intake is the hallmark characteristic of malnutrition. Creating a calorie deficit, i.e. an intentionally insufficient energy intake, is the hallmark of weight loss dieting. In Dietary Prescription for Intentional Weight Loss, we calculate the energy requirements and then subtract a number of hundreds of calories, or just use an off-the-shelf lower calorie plan. So if we look at this deficit through a malnutrition diagnosis lens, this could equate to a potential energy deficit of 20 to 40% and is meant to be maintained for months on end. For VLCDs, very low calorie diets, which typically use meal replacement shakes and the like to achieve a severe energy deficit, the deficit may be in the range of a 60 to 70% energy deficit, easily meeting the definition of malnutrition. A few episodes ago, I talked about the various methods by which energy requirements are calculated and how we've tended to systematically undercalculate energy requirements for larger bodied people, trying to always build in an energy deficit because of this idea that weight loss for larger bodies is a good thing. So be aware that the way you're calculating energy requirements may have this bias built into it. If you're calculating energy requirements using an adjusted body weight, then the likelihood is that this will underestimate actual energy needs to keep that person with a stable body weight. And this is particularly important for people who prescribe tube and vein feeds for larger hospitalized humans. Secondly, now, weight loss or body mass loss in terms of being diagnostic of malnutrition. A 10% body weight loss in the preceding 6 months may indicate mild to moderate malnutrition, and more than 10% over 6 months can indicate severe malnutrition. As an example, that's an 8 kilo loss in 6 months for someone starting at 80 kilos. And note that the intentionality of weight loss is irrelevant in the guidelines. It makes no difference to the predictive value of weight loss for malnutrition whether the weight loss was intentional, unintentional, driven by famine or illness. Thirdly, loss of subcutaneous fat from around the eyes, triceps, ribs. This is subjective to an extent. The level of fat loss for moderate malnutrition is marked as mild, and for severe malnutrition is severe. But if you don't know the person beforehand, it's kind of hard to assess it. For people with larger bodies, it's going to be the facial fat stores that are the most useful to look at. So the loss of the bulge under the eyes, that sort of eye area looks kind of hollow, and skin, particularly under the arms, may also have a loose, sort of thin appearance or hang. And fourth, loss of muscle mass. In smaller bodied people, it's the temples, clavicles, shoulders, interosseous muscles, scapula, thigh, and calf that are indicative of malnutrition assessment for muscle mass loss. In larger bodied people, again, the face is going to be the clearest place to look. So wasting of the temporalis muscle, so a hollowing of the temples on both sides. People with larger bodies are typically much more muscular than smaller bodied people. So muscle wasting will be present with weight loss, but may not be obvious because the starting point is a much larger muscle. So looking at the temples is useful because it's not a weight-bearing muscle. And also around the calf and thighs, there may be some loose skin, if particularly if the person's older than about 45. And a quote from a paper about orthopedic surgery and malnutrition: body fat and skeletal muscle are depleted late in the course of malnourishment. And this is so interesting given that body fat depletion is precisely what's prescribed for larger bodied people by many orthos before they operate. So the fifth sign is fluid accumulation, so swollen feet, ankles, swollen belly, which is called ascites. But it's only really an issue in illness-related malnutrition and in protein-insufficient energy malnutrition. So it's not so relevant in intentional weight loss. And then finally, the sixth sign is reduced grip strength. And this is such a subjective measure because of the normal variation in grip strengths of well-nourished humans. So grip strength can only really be thought of as a proxy for decreased functional capacity and has to be significantly decreased in order for it to be classified as part of severe malnutrition. Okay, so of those six things, so remember it's insufficient energy intake, weight loss, loss of subcutaneous fat, loss of muscle mass, fluid retention, and diminished functional capacity, only two of those have to be in play for a diagnosis of malnutrition. And what does malnutrition look like then in a larger person? Well, you can take a look at the finale episode of any of the Biggest Loser TV series. All of those people on the podiums are competing to be the most malnourished. Look for those hollowed out temples. Look for pale, loose skin, although most of them would have had a spray tan before going on screen. Brittle and dry hair, excessive hair shedding, dry skin, dizziness on standing. And behavioural signs of malnutrition include tiredness and irritability, attentional deficits and apathy. So voluntary weight loss dieting clearly puts people at least at risk of malnutrition. But people with high BMIs are routinely asked to reduce their weight before surgery to reduce perioperative risks. But if this is actually inducing malnutrition, they may be increasing their perioperative risks. A study by Fry and colleagues showed that pre-existing malnutrition or weight loss was a positive predictive variable for all 8 major surgery-associated never events. That's inexcusable outcomes in a healthcare setting events, with odds ratios ranging from 2.8 for post-operative pneumonia to 16.4 for intravascular device infection. It is bad news to operate on someone who's malnourished. And for those who are thinking about the 3 or so weeks of VLCD, so the shake prescription that's regularly prescribed for people with larger bodies before they undergo particularly abdominal surgery, the energy restriction only has to be sustained for a month and coupled with a greater than 5% weight loss in that time to be considered indicative of severe malnutrition. Preoperative weight loss should easily meet this definition for many people, and yet it's routinely prescribed out of a combination of historical thin bias tradition and surgeon comfort and equipment limitations. So larger livers are a bit harder to lift and get around to access deeper organs. But people's liver sizes also vary quite a lot from person to person. These pre-surgical protocols are promoting a wasted state before surgery. Healing from surgery itself then further raids muscle and fat stores for the increased requirements for tissue repair, post-surgical appetites often pretty low, bowel functions usually stuffed up from the anaesthetic and pain management medications used afterwards, leading to insufficient energy intake for a while after the operation, which worsens malnutrition risk. Then there's the usual issue of any post-operative adverse events being recorded against the person's still higher BMI and then attributed to BMI risk instead of a recent significant weight loss or acute malnutrition risk. Don't get me wrong, I believe the surgeons have their heart in the right place, but are being led astray by their assumptions about larger bodied people. And so a quick note about assessment of malnutrition across the lifespan. With children and adolescents, malnutrition can be assessed looking at whether growth is faltering. This is tricky in adolescents because they have these three consecutive high-velocity growth spurt years between 11 and 17, but you don't know when their growth spurt is going to happen. So if we take the case of a 12-year-old female adolescent who started to put on weight as part of puberty but has not yet gained much height, she freaks out and starts restricting food or over-exercising to reduce her body fat. That energy restriction will curb height growth, and if it's severe enough, it will stunt her growth permanently. If there are periods of meeting energy requirements, let's say in between rounds of dieting, perhaps involving binge eating behaviours, then there may be an opportunity for catch-up growth. However, undernutrition during adolescence is associated with low bone density, shorter adult height, low offspring birth weight, high blood pressure, and chronic disease. Coupled with the fact that dieting during adolescence is strongly associated with higher weight during adulthood, we end up with an adult that may be larger bodied and eventually diagnosed with a chronic disease. A cross-sectional survey would note her larger body and disease status and try to make a link between them, while the reality is that the seeds for her chronic disease were sown during periods of undernutrition during her adolescence, and her higher weight is a result of repeated dieting. I've mostly focused on the American guidelines, but there are European guidelines for the diagnosis of malnutrition too, from ESPEN, the European Society of Clinical Nutrition and Metabolism. And this is a really neat example of the consequences of using data to drive diagnosis cutoffs versus using expert consensus to formulate guidelines. So the American guidelines that I've covered in this episode were developed using a literature review of research relating to decreased functional capacity, adverse clinical outcomes, morbidity and mortality related to malnutrition. The European consensus statement used a process called a Delphi method, where a bunch of experts work through a problem via a series of rounds, and the outcomes are decided upon by consensus. Basically, it's a process that distills the beliefs of the majority. This, of course, makes it rife for also distilling bias. If you've got a bunch of biased experts in your Delphi panel, you're going to weaponize that bias through the process. They decided that malnutrition should be diagnosed based on either unintentional weight loss of more than 5% in 3 months or 10% from habitual weight and a BMI of less than 18.5 or weight loss as described before and low fat-free mass index. Despite recognizing that because the prevalence of larger bodies in the population means that some people will be malnourished at a higher BMI than 18.5, they've still stuck with the cutoff of 18.5 because that's what the World Health Organization uses. Ugh. Someone with a long-term larger body who's lost weight to the point of having a BMI of less than 18.5 would actually have similar level of wasting to a smaller bodied person with a much, much lower BMI, like an immediate death kind of level of BMI. You don't lose skin or connective tissue when you lose weight. Ugh. Delphi studies aren't all bad, but in this case, where we should be examining the predictive value of various characteristics for undernutrition and actual outcomes, they've ended up with a document that's essentially we reckon, and their recommendations will have led to far worse clinical outcomes via ignoring severe malnutrition in larger bodied people, whether it be from intentional or unintentional weight loss. And finally, word on the nutritional treatment of primary malnutrition caused by weight loss dieting, food insecurity, and famine. If the malnutrition is severe and the period for being at risk of refeeding syndrome has passed, that is once they're medically stable, prescribe meals until appetite signals return, and then a varied diet eaten to appetite will correct cases of primary malnutrition in an otherwise metabolically functional human. And all of this should be overseen by a dietitian, obviously, in perfect world conditions, but what happens out there in the real world is that people who have done this sort of severe dieting out there alone, on their own, without medical or health professional supervision do end up refeeding themselves in those periods in between their dieting cycles. Nutritionally, a varied diet that at least includes food from all of the core food groups is most likely to result in nutritional repletion. Of course, psychologically, it's important for the person to truly have unlimited access to enough food to heal from the psychological impacts of food insecurity and cognitions around body image, and the drivers of dieting, etc. All of those need to be addressed comprehensively. So to sum up, intentional weight loss dieting amounts to intentional undernutrition and puts people at risk of primary malnutrition and at risk of exacerbating secondary malnutrition. Undernutrition can occur across the weight span and life course and should be suspected in everyone who's weight loss dieting. Maintenance of significant weight loss, i.e. continued weight suppression, can be thought of as chronic undernutrition. The very predictable weight regain that most people experience within a few years of intentional weight loss should be considered as a period of nutritional repletion. A moderately to severely undernourished body, regardless of BMI, puts people at risk of all sorts of negative short and long-term consequences, from cognitive deficits to perioperative risks to chronic disease risks, most of which are a far greater magnitude than the difference between the higher BMI mortality risk when lifestyle behaviours are taken into account. So, that's it for this episode. The supporting materials, which include the show notes, research links, and self-test quiz, are available upfront for current subscribers, only $5 a month, a bargain, or can be purchased in a bundle if you're catching up later. See unpackingweightscience.com for details. And next time, episode 18 is Obesity, Understanding Risk versus Disease. In this episode, I'll be talking about the flawed basis and consequences of the decision by some organisations to deem all people with a BMI of over 30 as diseased. To do this, I'll deep dive into risk factors, surrogate markers and diagnostics as they relate to high body weight and chronic disease. Until next time, goodbye.